Do you remember learning about Alexander Hamilton and how important he was to the formation of the United States? Do you remember being shocked to learn that he died in a duel with the sitting vice president of the United States, Aaron Burr? There's really nothing to compare with it in our history. And so we continue to try to make sense of the duel and whatever led up to it. Our guest this hour makes an effort anew in the book War of Two, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and the Duel That Stunned the Nation. John Sedgwick is journalist, novelist, biographer, memoirist, and more, the author of many articles and the book In My Blood about the well-documented and well-placed Sedgwick family. John Sedgwick, pleasure to have you here on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, it's a thrill for me, too. Thank you.
So was it the family memoir that you were researching when you fell into the Burr-Hamilton story?
Yes, it is. And before I say anything more, I have to say that there is some terrible irony that I should be talking about Hamilton on the Jefferson Network.
It's pretty funny, isn't it?
How ignominious is that for poor Mr. Hamilton, who went through his entire life hating the guts of Jefferson? Anyway, I'll endure. Yes, it was indeed my ancestor the letter that he received from Hamilton that first got me going on this. I was researching the history of my family when I stumbled on this letter. It was the last letter that Alexander Hamilton ever wrote before he went off to his doom at Weehawken, New Jersey on July 11th, 1804. And this letter was written the night before. It's dated July 10th, 1804. And that it was written to my direct ancestor, Theodore Sedgwick, who had been the Speaker of the House of Representatives in 1800 for this epic election that made Jefferson president. But he was also a close legislative ally of Hamilton, and it was in that guise that Hamilton was writing to him. And, you know, it was a really amazing thing to see that letter because it started out being very casual. You know, I have a couple of letters on my desk from you, Hamilton wrote, and I've been meaning to get back to them. I have a long one in the works, but I needed to dash something off for you now. I've been very busy. Well, that's not the kind of thing you would think that someone would write when on the eve of his doom, right? Imagine.
I'll write you one later, yes.
A duel is just so inconceivable anyway, but for him it was a very immediate fate, and that he could write any kind of cogent letter under the circumstances is to me remarkable.
So what do you bring to the work that might not have appeared in previous writing about it?
That's a really excellent question, and what I would say is that I wanted to bring this to life. This was a historical item. It was a sort of a factoid. It was kind of a curiosity, but it had never been really explored in a book. And that this was, in a significant way, it was fateful for the nation, and I didn't feel that its full dimension had been appreciated. And what's more, I thought that it would be a way to enliven characters from the era of the Founding Fathers who seem, quite honestly, sort of permanently dead. There on the face of the $10 bill, Hamilton is. But you never get the sense that he was ever alive in the way that he would have thought of himself. And I wanted to bring these people to life as you would, and think of them as you would your friends. And you would know them, know sort of what they're about, where they're from, what they're feeling, and why they do what they do. That kind of immediacy, I think, is often lost in history books, is rarely even captured in biographies, and I wanted to sort of get these people because I feel that they had never been gotten before.
What is the standard view, John, of the source of the duel, and does your view after your research differ?
Well, the standard view is that it comes, as it indeed does come, from most immediately from a dinner party in February of 1804, some months, like 5 or 6 months before the actual duel. And that there, Hamilton was with some of his Federalist friends, and they were talking about the upcoming election in New York for governor. And the question, of course, came up to Hamilton, what do you think about this fellow Burr? Well, what does he think about this fellow Burr? He's been hating Burr for at least a decade, and he said that he thought of Burr as a dangerous man. Well, that word dangerous was picked up by another person at the dinner party whom Hamilton didn't particularly know. He was an in-law of the man who was his host. And that he then retailed it to the newspapers, and it ended up in the New York Evening Post.
Which Hamilton started, didn't he?
Which Hamilton started 3 years before, and that came out, you know, like 2 months later. I mean, things were very slow-moving in media circles. This was before the Internet.
No Twitter, right?
Yeah, no tweets. And then it wasn't until 2 months after that that Burr found out about it, that he actually read it himself. And he was, now at that point, he had lost that election. He was a little pissed anyway. Now, Hamilton had spent much of the election season just attacking Burr up and down on the state of New York. He had lost in a very lopsided election, and that he was kind of loaded for bear anyway. And then he saw this, that Hamilton had called him dangerous. Now, in that era, there was something called honor that people don't fully appreciate today. And honor was more than your reputation. It was everything about you. It was your valor. It was your masculinity. It was your pride, and countless other things. And those were the things that made you who you were. And that when someone attacks your honor, as they did with this word dangerous, you have to respond seriously. And that's what he did.
He did indeed. And so we'll talk more about what led up to the duel and find out a bit more about both Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton as they grew up and the families they grew up in. John Sedgwick is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is War of Two. We'll come back and talk more with John and take your phone calls and emails about the duel and all the things that led up to it when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10.
Now let's make that random call with today's $10,000 question. Who shot Alexander Hamilton in that famous duel?
Hello? Hello, for $10,000.
Aaron Burr.
Excuse me?
Aaron Burr. Oh, hold on, let me go for milk. No!
Possibly the most famous commercial in American history, the Got Milk ad, in which somebody with a mouthful of peanut butter can't say Aaron Burr, which everybody knows was is the guy who shot Alexander Hamilton in that famous duel in 1804. It's the subject of John Sedgwick's book, War of Two, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and the Duel That Stunned the Nation. Join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So to the beginning, I did not realize until now, John, that Aaron Burr's maternal grandfather was quite a big deal himself.
I'll say Jonathan Edwards was the leading theologian, a strict Calvinist from the middle of the 18th century, and that he was the closest. If you sort of combine a movie star, a rock star, and an athlete, star athlete, you would get something of the dimension of Jonathan Edwards. In those days, religion was like the sole common currency for the media, so that if you were a leading light, as he was, you were pretty well established. And yes, so that to be the grandson of Jonathan Edwards was a very big deal.
So quite a pedigree for him. And then on the other hand, Alexander Hamilton rose up from illegitimate birth. Was that rare for his time?
I don't know how rare it was. Certainly more rare than now, I would expect, but I don't know. I mean, that's a good question, because nowadays the sense of marriage is loosening a little bit, and that the sanctions against the word you never ever hear the word bastard anymore. I mean, I think that's significant. I think that the illegitimacy in the sense of being born out of quote unquote wedlock that is probably far more common now than it was then, but it was stigmatized then in a way it isn't now. And that when John Adams, as president, referred to Hamilton as the bastard brat of a Scottish peddler, that was a pretty severe statement and summed up the general attitude that Hamilton had to combat. He was a nothing and a nobody from nowhere, and that was his burden, that he had to prove himself Burr did not have to prove himself. Burr was made from the beginning. He was already Sterling, and that everybody recognized him as such. Hamilton had to earn his keep, and that he had to. He was a fighter and a scrapper and an unbelievably energetic sort of proponent of himself and his ideas. He was just absolutely tireless. No one would ever accuse Burr of that.
Well, Burr's mother did write about him as a sly and mischievous. So what else do we know about the young Aaron?
Well, the young Aaron was, in fairness, was a sufferer of the highest order, that by the time he was three, that all four of the major caregivers in his life had died. That first his father died of a severe fever, then his wife, then his mother died of something similar, that his grandfather, the celebrated Jonathan Edwards, came down to sort of take care of the family. He died of smallpox, which is the most hideous disease imaginable. And then his wife, the grandmother of Aaron Burr, came down, months later when she could finally summon the courage after the death of her husband and she could fortify herself, that she came down. And then she died. So all four were gone by the time he was three. And that, I believe, left this terrible vacancy at the center of his heart and soul, that he just, ever after that, he had a terrible time with affiliation, that his friend, he was a most mysterious man. He would never say openly what he believed. He was always a very covert person, that he liked to write things in code. He was prone to conspiracies and that he would organize. He was the kind of conspiracy theorist that created conspiracies. And that he also was the kind of, he was very dark, very suspicious. And I think that that was the result of his birth. That Hamilton, on the other hand, he was, his mother died when he was very young. He was just 12. His father disappeared. He was probably not even the son of the man that he thought of as his father, but rather of a much more highborn gentleman named Stevens, who was there on the island of St. Croix. But he didn't even realize this, so that there was this case of sort of peculiar identity. Who was he? Where was he from, really? What station in life was his? That one of the things about Hamilton, that one of the terrible or amazing ironies of the story, is that Hamilton always looked up, that he was somebody who aspired constantly to join the privileged class, to be a member of the establishment, and so that he identified with the elite, and people accused him of being a monarchist and a royalist, largely for that reason, that he styled himself that way. Burr, on the other hand, had a common touch that Hamilton never did, and that his great contribution, really his only contribution to political life, was an ability to connect with the working class and actually reach out to them to solicit their vote personally, rather than through intermediaries, as was the custom of the time. And so that he went literally house to house and would explain his views and solicit support. And then he also did this thing where it used to be in New York and probably elsewhere that there was a property requirement, that you had to own property in New York in order to vote. Well, that obviously restricted the franchise significantly. And Burr thought a way around that by developing what he called the tontine, by which you could get a tiny, tiny, tiny piece of somebody's real estate, and then if you had only 1 square inch costing you 3 cents or something like that, then you would qualify. So that he would gather 1,000 people or 10,000 people to own a single property, just a shred of it, and that would be enough to expand the electorate. And that's significant. But it also shows that which way he wanted to go. He wanted to reach out to the common people, and did.
Interesting contradictions in both men. We're talking about Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr in John Sedgwick's book War of Two here on the Jefferson Exchange, particularly with the fact that Hamilton is a pretty good representative of what the American ideal is, that you can rise up from nothing to become something, yet he believed in the aristocracy.
Yes, but I think that it's sort of understandable that people look up, generally. When they come from nothing, they want something more. Who wouldn't? And that they want something more than that. I mean, it's the great American story of going from rags to riches. That's what we're after. And that was absolutely what was true for Hamilton. He didn't seek money, but he certainly did seek standing as a way of legitimizing himself and to undo a lot of the scorn that was heaped on him as this kind of waif that had washed up from the shore back in the 1771, I think, when he arrived. And that was definitely his ambition, and it shaped his politics. The thing about Hamilton that is so distinctive was his belief in the grandeur of the United States, that he believed that if these 13 colonies could truly unite into a common state, that with a strong central government, that they would come to rule the world, and that was what he was after. He wanted to create a new British Empire on the American shore that would be fully the equal of England and perhaps more, and that is what he did.
The book again is War of Two, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and the Duel That Stunned the Nation. John Sedgwick is the author and our guest on The Exchange. You can join us with your comments and questions on topic at 800-838-3760 on the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So they were both still young men when the revolution began, and you just talked about their leanings at the outset, Hamilton thinking more in terms of another sort of British empire. What was Burr thinking about how he was leaning?
It's really unclear. I mean, his political views, I think, were never fully formed. That one of the things that Hamilton hated about him was that he kept oscillating between the Federalist view of the world and the Jeffersonian Republican view of the world, which really could not be squared. They were as different as night and day. And so that one of the things that is surprising is that Hamilton saw the revolution coming much sooner than Burr did. Burr was an exquisitely educated guy from Princeton himself, and that he was in with a lot of the leading lights of Princeton, Elizabethtown, where he grew up. But he was just carousing. He was hanging out with women. He was spending his days in wine and song and women. That was kind of it. And then he was sort of surprised to learn that there was a revolution coming, and that when it did come, that his interest was solely in advancement, that he wanted to be an officer in this great conflict and to make a name for himself with his valor. He didn't particularly take an interest in the cause behind it. Hamilton, by contrast, he was a student at Columbia when this, or King's College as it was, and when the first whiff of the revolution started to come along, and that his initial instinct was to side with the British because they were the establishment, that he viewed the colonists and the revolutionaries as a bunch, as largely riffraff, that it was a mob, he thought, that it, instinctively. And that it wasn't until, so the story goes, that he went to Boston and conferred with after the famous Tea Party, and conferred with people like Samuel Adams, one of the revolutionaries up there, and got a sense of what this was really about, that he started to change his mind on the subject, and then became, as Hamilton always did, the most fervid proponent of the cause, as you could imagine, and he was capable of winging a speech on this subject at some length that would just astound people. And then he started writing essays in favor, and before you knew it, he was a champion of the cause.
I'm struck by some of the similarities between the men. They both seem to be willing to learn warcraft through books, so they were both big believers in learning through books. How was it that Hamilton ended up in Washington's attention and his inner circle?
Well, it was, Washington was on the lookout for talented young men, and that when they were... That after this terrible defeat in the first battles in New York, where the British just swept across Long Island and almost drove the American army, such as it was, past Brooklyn and just dumped them into the East River. I mean, that could have been the end of it right there. But it was sort of like at Dunkirk, where they were able to scramble together enough boats to save the army and continue the fight in first in Manhattan and then north of it in Westchester County. And it was there that that Washington first encountered Hamilton. He was leading an artillery brigade, and that he was one of the few soldiers that are officers that was able to keep his head when the British were basically overrunning all the positions. And Washington said, in effect, who is that dashing young man? And summoned him for an interview and basically fell in love with him, and that they were scarcely parted for the next 20 years. They ran the revolution together, and then they ran the government together. It was love at first sight, at least from Washington's side. I mean, Hamilton always chafed under the idea of any kind of paternal influence. You would think that he would have a father thing, but he really didn't. He resisted fathers, and he always resisted having too much control by Washington over him. But he also recognized that Washington was his ticket to to success, and I think that was the relationship between them.
So Hamilton could keep his head on the mission in the middle of a tough fight. I get the sense from what you relay in the book that even then Burr was the kind of guy who, even in the middle of a fight, would perceive a slight.
He was sensitive to a slight, as was Hamilton. I mean, they were both very prickly people, and that they wanted, there's something interesting about ambition, which is that you're looking up, but you're also sensitive to down, that you don't want to be put down. You're sensitive, extremely sensitive to people who don't accord you the proper position that you see for yourself. And any kind of slight is going to be magnified. There's this famous incident when Washington and Hamilton meet on the staircase at headquarters in Morristown, I think it was, and that Hamilton was coming downstairs to talk to his friend Lawrence, and Washington was going upstairs into his office. And Washington says on the way, you know, come see me, I need to talk to you about something. And Hamilton says, in a moment, basically, I'm going to talk to Lawrence. Well, he dallies in talking to Lawrence, and he doesn't get back to Washington on the staircase for 10 minutes. Washington had his pocket watch out, basically, counting the minutes. And Washington said, I was expecting you here. And Hamilton said, I told you I was going to be with Lawrence. And he said, why? That was, you thought it'd be a minute. And it's been 10. It wasn't 10. It was more like 4. You know, isn't it like that? And then at the end of it, Hamilton says, oh, screw it. I'm done with you. I'm leaving the army. And Washington was just totally crestfallen to lose his chief aide. He was the indispensable man. But that's the way it was, that Washington was putting down Hamilton. He was trying to run him, and that Hamilton was not going to be run. Same thing with Burr, that when he didn't get the promotion that he was expecting from Washington, he was pissed. He saw other people getting it. He wasn't getting it. He complained. That just made it worse. You know, all these things. It's funny how touchy these people were, but they were totally touchy.
But very effective, too, in a lot of ways. War of Two is the book. It's about Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and their duel. John Sedgwick wrote it. Time for an aside here. At this point in history, what is the legal status of duels?
In 1804, they were illegal, both in New York and in New Jersey. But people went across to New Jersey to then, as now, to do things that you could never get away with in Manhattan. So they went to New Jersey not because it was legal, but because it was ignored. And the big surprise that Burr had was that he imagined that it would be ignored this time too. But he comes back, and that he's immediately not hailed as a hero for upholding his honor, but he's called a murderer for having killed one of the greatest men of the age. And that's what gets things going for an indictment. See, in those days, the forensics of a murder investigation weren't nearly as important as popular sentiment, and that if somebody believed you killed somebody, an indictment would follow. That's all it took. They wouldn't actually spend much time over the corpse. And in this case, that Hamilton, that when Hamilton died, that people were so appalled that they wanted to take action, and so that led to the indictment against Burr, and it would have led to his arrest if they'd ever been able to catch him.
So it sounds like conventional justice was not a great deal better than lynching at that time. If the crowd believed that you were guilty, you were guilty.
Well, you would then be tried. That would lead to an arrest, but it wouldn't necessarily cause a conviction. But, you know, I mean, to be arrested for murder if you are a politician and the sitting vice president, that's a pretty long fall, and you don't recover from that. To be put on trial was tantamount to, you know, losing whatever was left of your reputation.
Had duels been legal under the British system before the revolution?
No. Well, I think that they were sort of winked at operations, that they were sort of, secret society or something, and the rules of a secret society, and it's similar to the kind of misadventures that undergraduates put each other to when they're joining clubs, that is something that is, you know, it's in the shadows, people don't really know, and it's, there's such a long tradition of it. I mean, it goes back to the medieval times with knights whacking at each other to prove their worth for some lady or other. It's appalling what people will do in the name of honor.
Right, the old might makes right belief. We'll talk more with John Sedgwick about his book War of Two and take phone calls and emails when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John Sedgwick, journalist, novelist, biographer, memoirist, and more. He wrote the book In My Blood about his well-documented and well-placed family, the Sedgwicks, and now he's writing about Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr and the duel that stunned the nation in his book War of Two. His great-great-great-grandfather, Theo Sedgwick, had been the Speaker of the House at the time that Aaron Burr was not elected president and Thomas Jefferson was, largely through the offices of Alexander Hamilton. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the duel that followed several years later. 800-838-3760 by phone or jx@jeffnet.org by email. Here's a call from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Sedgwick. John, go ahead. We'll have to get John back on the line. He might have listened off to his radio, which is always a problem because of our 10-second delay system. So people are across the room listening and not realizing they're up. So Hamilton, you talked about how prickly he was. Both of the men were relatively touchy about slights and perceived slights. But it sounds like Hamilton was additionally gifted at stepping on the toes of anyone.
Yes, he was... he was a hothead, let's face it, that if he wouldn't just be sensitive to slights, Burr, you know, in the way that Burr was. Burr would do a sort of quiet seethe, but he wouldn't actually act until the very end when he acted in the way we know against Hamilton. But Hamilton himself would take action and make a bad situation infinitely worse. And the classic case is that when he decided that he'd had it with John Adams, who was at that point the sitting president of and a member of the Federalist Party, so theoretically as close to him politically as any person could be, and he turned on him and wrote this 100-page diatribe that went out to almost every newspaper in the land, calling Adams everything but stark raving mad, and only pulled up very short of that mark. It was a stunning dismissal of Adams. The fact is that Adams, you know, he's sort of a hallowed figure like so many of the founding fathers, but that he was also a very difficult man, very prickly, very short tempered. He'd go off. Just quickly against almost anyone, and that, you know, he was caught in this terrible bind where he'd decided to keep all of Washington's cabinet, but the cabinet was not loyal to him, so they were always saying bad things about him. They weren't actually acting out on his orders and different things, and so that he felt very isolated and quite irritable about this. Well, Hamilton seized on that and made it worse.
John, you know, now that I think of it, John Adams was the, you know, you never want to be the person who succeeds a legend. You know, you don't want to be the coach after John Wooden, that sort of thing.
That's right. Or after Bill Belichick, to put it in my own terms here in New England.
Well done.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's a tall order. And also, I mean, not only was he president, but he was, you know, the founder of the country, the first president, the one, I have to say that of all the people in the founding fathers that I read about and know about, Washington is the one who by far earns my admiration. What a stalwart character he was. This was a general who had no army, and when he did get an army, it was terribly underpaid, and that it was had no training, no backing, and it was really helpless in the early stages anyway against this British army that was, you know, the strongest in the world, and kept mowing down his poor farmers, basically. Okay, so then he wins the revolution. He gets into the government, and at first he just doesn't want to do this. He is so spent after the war. He just wants to go back to his farm and just hang out there with his wife, a lovely Martha Washington. But they say, no, we need you. And who is the person to recruit him to the office but Hamilton? And he says, well, okay, but maybe can I just serve 2 years rather than the full four? I mean, really, I'm so tired of this. Hamilton simply doesn't respond to that and leaves him with the idea that maybe he can. But then he gets in. It's very fractious. I mean, he's got Jefferson on the one side believing this, and then Hamilton on the other believing exactly the opposite. These are all strong-willed men who are extremely accomplished. They all think that they're better than Washington, or certainly better than each other. And he's got to keep this whole squabbling cabal together, working in a common direction, and you know, and creating all of these different things. I mean, who knew how to run a government? I mean, what exactly, for instance, what do you call the president? Is he Your Excellency? They just didn't know the terms, and they ended up with calling him Mr. President, of course. But that was after much deliberation. It was a subject to be discussed in the Senate, and so many things like that we now take for granted. Washington, how should he meet the people? Should he touch? Should he, you know, greet them casually? Should he spend any time with them? Should he have people to dinner? You know, stuff that we've now got pretty well worked out, but was not worked out at the time at all. And that was what Washington was up against, and he handled it beautifully. And he set the standard for presidents, all presidents to come. And everybody on some level, whether they realize it or not, is measuring himself against Washington.
All right, let's try to take that call again. Here is John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Sedgwick, writing about the Hamilton-Burr duel in War of Two.
Hi, thanks. So I'm sure you're going to get to the actual duel itself, but I remember reading in history that Hamilton, who is the guy who got killed, right, he was actually a crack shot, and Burr was a rank amateur. Is there any truth to that, or did that actually happen?
Oh, good question.
Anyway,
thanks for that.
Thanks.
I think the truth of that is probably more the opposite, that, you know, Hamilton had a bit of a career in the field, but not much, meaning during the Revolution. He was mostly serving the war at a desk. Burr was out in the field, and he killed any number of people. We don't know whether Hamilton actually shot to kill in any instances. And the question really was, that in the duel itself, that there were tales of Burr that actually, practicing before the duel for like a month in back of his house at a target range, essentially, that he'd set up. Hamilton did nothing of the kind. And, you know, I should add that it wasn't done to practice. And you weren't supposed to be good at this. You were supposed to be a gentleman who was, you know, only average. If you were better than that, you know, that was to your advantage. But you weren't supposed to be a crack shot. That gave you an unfair advantage, and that was not something that a gentleman would seek.
So was it really like trying to just blow off noisemakers to indicate your displeasure with one another and not actually cause any physical harm?
Well, that's a really good question. That sometimes that they, you know, just aimed in the air, and the two duelists would realize that that was enough, that it just like that, noisemakers. Other times they would aim below the waist, and so that they would just pop somebody in the leg and keel him over and then call it a day. And other times they would just aim and miss, because the thing about a duel is that these guys were unpracticed, that Hamilton had been, quote-unquote, in 11 duels, but he'd never actually been the one holding the gun. He was either a second, or he challenged someone to a duel and it never happened, or the someone challenged him and it never happened. But this time it happened, and Burr had not been in a duel either. And so that these guys, I mean, imagine, you're not used to holding a gun in your hand. These dueling pistols are unusual. I mean, they're heavier than normal. They're ornate. They aren't particularly accurate. They're something that are more ceremonial than functional. And that when you pulled the trigger, you really didn't know where the bullet was going to go. It was like firing off a cannon. I mean, there's just no particular accuracy to it. They're very heavy pulls, as they say. The trigger is simply hard to yank on. They're very heavy. They're like bricks in your hand. So that the end, you're scared to death. I mean, even if you try to be as resolute as possible when you're facing down somebody at 10 yards, I mean, you can really see who and what is going to kill you. And that's got to be a terrifying moment.
Give us the gist of the presidential election that Aaron Burr did not win, and what Alexander Hamilton was doing behind the scenes to make sure that that's exactly what happened.
Wow. A gist is a little hard to do, but I'll try. This was the epic election of 1800, when Washington's term was up and Adams was 4 years into his term, and then he gets blindsided by Hamilton. So he's definitely listing if he were a boat. And so that he did. So there's this campaign essentially between Jefferson and Adams. Each of them has their vice president, Pinckney for Adams and Burr for Jefferson. But the thing is that in those days, that when you voted for someone, for two candidates like Jefferson and Burr, you voted that each one was positioned as a presidential candidate. That the way it was that four people would run. It was sort of assumed that the two of them were vice presidents, but it wasn't stated, and that you voted the presidential and vice presidential and the two leaders would the number one and the number two would team off as the president and vice president. They could be of opposite parties, as they were in the case of Adams and Jefferson. But what happened in this instance was that the two leaders tied. They both got the exact same electoral votes, and that the system in those days was, when that happened, was to throw it into the House of Representatives and have each delegation vote as a single vote, and that then they were tied right exactly between Burr and Jefferson. Well, what to do? Hamilton decided that he would, that much as he loathed Jefferson for opposing him in every particular of his principles, he hated Burr more for the reasons that we've said, so that he decided, to the surprise of my ancestor Theodore Sedgwick, that he was going to go with Jefferson. Well, my man Sedgwick was going to go for Burr, because he felt that Burr was more malleable and would be more indulgent to the Federalist cause. Well, they didn't, but okay, so what's going to happen? Presumably, there'd be some politicking going on, that Jefferson would say, okay, you Burr people, I'll do this, that, and the other if you give me my vote. Well, Jefferson was too set in his principles to do any of the horse trading. And the thing about Burr is he never said what he wanted. He never said whether he wanted to be president at all. He didn't say a word on this subject. He wasn't even in Washington. He was up in Albany. His daughter was getting married. And he didn't communicate a single public word on the subject the whole time that this thing was cooking. And so it went through 36 ballots over several days in February until finally one of the delegates from Delaware decided he'd had enough and he was going to throw his vote to Jefferson, and the whole thing switched, and Jefferson was elected by the narrowest of margins. And on that, the world turned, because going from the Federalists to the Jeffersonians was going from this to that, it was a total transformation. It was down with the central government, up with the states, and towards the people, away from the elite, and all of that. And that happened on that night.
So it was 4 years later then three and a half at this point, that the duel took place. It seems like there was plenty of time from the original challenge and you know, the answer of, you know, I need my satisfaction, plenty of time and negotiations to head it off. I mean,
the election was the background, but the nearer background was, of course, this dinner party and the word dangerous. Burr got wind of that maybe a month and a half ahead of the duel, and the way it actually shook out was that once Burr found out about it, he sent a crisp letter to Hamilton to say, "What's this with the word dangerous? What do you mean by this? Did you really say it?" And Hamilton had to say, "Well, yes, actually, I did say that." And then he says, Burr does, that he'd heard further that Hamilton had even more despicable things to say about Burr than that. And that's what caused Burr to blow his top. Even more despicable. What could those be, he demanded of Hamilton. Well, Hamilton at that point was in a terrible bind because he had said plenty of more despicable things than that. He had, you know, accused him of every possible bad motivation for every possible thing that Burr had done. And this was in the letters that he had written to people, that it was in documents. It was something he simply couldn't take back without being accused of being a trimmer himself, and that he just didn't want that in his reputation. So he had to stick by what he had said, and he then tried to wriggle out of the despicable thing by saying, well, you know, there's despicable and there's despicable. I mean, you tell me where to draw the line. And Burr said, I've had it with this kind of casuistry, this kind of what's the meaning of is sorts of comments, and that we'll settle this with handguns.
And indeed they did, and Alexander Hamilton ended up dead. Aaron Burr never served any time for that, lived for several more years. All that detailed in the book War of Two, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and the Duel That Stunned the Nation. John Sedgwick wrote it and joined us today. John, thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been a really nice conversation. I appreciate
it. Well, take care.
Yeah, bye.